let me tell my story, friend, that you might learn to stay away from sin. I took a life not mine to take, imprisoned for this haunting dread mistake. My heart was harder than my soul. They sentenced me to life without parole, where no one cares, we're all the same, and I must wear this number for my name.
Strong. That was Cherry Homes, one of the great bluegrass bands playing right now in the United States. So, welcome to the Q Report, which stands for the Quotidian Report.
There'll be a quiz later.
Don't forget about the headphones now. This is, I'm here, Patrick Martins, with Mark Marabella.
Hello.
And we are coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're broadcasting out of two green shipping containers, which are actually colored green, but they're also very green because they are the cleanest form of architecture in that they're already built structures that are being recycled to be lived in or broadcast from.
And grown on, as you can hear the sound of green happening above us.
Yes, if you can hear that sound, Alice Waters very generously gave a grant to Roberta's and the Heritage Radio Network to plant a organic garden up on the top. And it's amazing what these guys have done. They have a whole water filtration system and all these plants growing. So,
fresh eats.
Fresh eats. This our last hour was brought to you by the Hearst Ranch. And this hour is brought to you by TechServe. And in this whole world of technology, TechServe is one of the old school businesses that treat people well, are very efficient, and they very generously donated some equipment to the Heritage Radio Network.
So, everything Mac, all the time.
Everything Mac, all the time. So thanks to TechServe. You can link to them from our website. So here we are on the Q Report, which again stands for quotidian, which means everyday, day-to-day kind of mundane things that go on. I just saw the movie Gomorrah, and that was a movie about quotidian culture in Naples.
I haven't seen it. Was it good?
Yeah. I was talking to an Italian friend who said basically Scorsese could have just left a camera on a street post on any corner in downtown Naples and could have made that movie.
So they call it Gomorrah as a reference to the Bible, as in Sodom and Gomorrah?
I think so. Maybe
there was debauch? Is a lot of debauchery?
Yeah, there wasn't actually a very violent film, but it was very quotidian. So this first quotidian hour, we have entitled Roots, and we're going to cover a few stories. We're going to cover the Verizon and rural America, and broadband access. We're going to do a piece. These pieces are about 8 minutes each, again, covering this idea of roots, community in the brain. Then we're going to come to the Brooklyn Monument in Fort Greene Park and the Revolutionary War. And then we're going to get into a difference between heritage and slow and, you know, good versus commodity, which we view as the lowest common denominator of food. So that's, and then we're going to have Brian Kenny, the rancher.
He's fabulous.
Yeah, very, very good. Very, very good talker and rancher, and definitely a great friend of Heritage. So, Mark, tell us, we covered the story in the news about Verizon promising 4G wireless for rural America, and it was an article by Marguerite Reardon in CNET Reviews. And basically, we learned from this article that only 38% of rural America have access to high-speed internet.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, actually, if you think about this day and age. And we were just having a conversation off air with Lorenzo about how he can imagine going someplace to go get his fresh drinking water, which we almost do now, bottled water. We've come from free tap water to going to buying bottled water, but he said he can't imagine living without internet. And here are these people in the middle of the country that I don't have 4G Wi-Fi.
I mean, our friends talk about, I can't get wireless right here. You know, I can't get it in the subway. Meanwhile, people in their homes and offices, if you know, no matter what their business is, it's just impossible to get in certain parts of the country. And that speaks to, you know, a lot of things, the haves and the have-nots. I mean, I think we kind of take free access to information for granted.
Yeah. I can't wait till it comes to New York.
Yeah, it's here already.
I mean,
Mark.
In between, I know, but the point is that, you know, when you're in the subway between the sort of the steel and concrete canyons in Manhattan, I mean, the 4G networks aren't working very well often. So in some ways, there are blackouts in the city. We understand what it is to live without it in that way, too.
Now, would you say then that internet is elitist? because not everyone has access to it. So, you know, we shouldn't take it for granted that everyone has it.
Actually, I look at this issue as it, well, it shouldn't be if it is. I wouldn't define it as such. That this is very much similar to the Tennessee Valley Authority sort of bringing electricity to the center of the country. And ironically, here we are in a time, as they say, you know, second worst to the Depression, where we're trying to, you know, the Obama administration specifically is trying to extend as a policy into rural. And of course, access to information is universal. I think everybody needs it and everybody should have it. More information is better for everybody, I think.
Well, you know, the Obama administration is definitely, you know, thinks this is an important issue because they've allocated $7.2 billion for projects that bring broadband and internet access to rural towns and communities. And that's, you know, part of the whole, you know, thinking about the have-nots as well, even within our own country.
And I think partly that issue, as always, in, you know, again, comparing New York, where we're broadcasting from, in Brooklyn versus a rural, there's similar issues in the sense that New York sometimes suffers from being behind because it's so condensed. It takes so long to change infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I'm in downtown Brooklyn. How old is that? It's one of the oldest cities in America, and yet I'm waiting for optic cables to be dug in. It's similar to they have the opposite problem that things are so spread out. It takes a very long time and very few customers relatively in the middle of the country. So, but it's good. It needs to happen, and I'm glad it is happening finally.
Well, you know, over the next few issues, I'm sure we're going to talk about this issue of, you know, the haves and the have-nots, the high, the low. You know, I'm in Heritage Foods, which, you know, sells very high-end and, you know, I guess arguably expensive proteins. You know, meanwhile, you do very, you know, esoteric issues in the documentary world, you know, and sometimes I wonder if we maybe live in a more closed, you know, like we think we're preaching in to the world, but really we're just preaching to the converted.
Well, I would argue no, that's not the case for in both our cases. In your case, I think it's very interesting that, of course, you've made a commodity from people who are living and working in these communities in the middle of the country, in farmland, in Kansas City, in Missouri, mm-hmm. In Iowa, in farmers in fisheries, natural fisheries in the Northwest. So I would argue, in fact, you're bringing their culture to everybody else, and that there's nothing elitist about that. Likewise for me, my documentaries appear on Discovery or National Geographic, and many of the people who watch those things are in, you know, all over the country. So mm-hmm. we're bringing these things out. I think that's exactly what we're doing. We're trying to jump over that sort of our little a small little niche that we live in. I think all of us live like that, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, some of us try to extend beyond.
Well, in terms of our sound effects, we just got this new sound effects board, the elitist issue. These are the sound effect for golf people clapping.
Yes, that's very refined.
And this is the have-nots of the crowds cheering.
The crowds are happy about getting the internet.
Yes, exactly, and they will one day.
It's very much, you know, I would also say maybe I'm bending the topic a little bit, but it's very much a roots culture because the internet, because of course one of the most visited, the three things that people visit most on the internet. Number one is looking for their roots, mm-hmm. is finding genealogy. Actually, it used to be stocks. I don't think it's up there anymore, and probably porn is pretty high up there still. It's mm-hmm. number one or two, but. Certainly about origins in that way.
Well, definitely it is roots. I mean, it's the root of a problem, lack of information, and it's also those roots are being planted. And we applaud Verizon, who ironically hasn't even applied for any of this money that's available. They just, I guess, promised to do this on their own. So more power to them. I hope they can get with the government and that soon we could be a country where everyone has equal opportunity for information.
I'm also very jealous of the people who have Verizon service because I see them actually talking in the train, which is amazing. And they're getting, I don't know if it's good and bad, of course, but they're getting calls inside a subway car underneath, you know, how many feet of concrete and cement, which is pretty amazing. They have really good service, actually.
And doesn't James Earl Jones do their voiceover, the greatest voiceover guy of all time? Verizon.
The voice of CNN and Darth Vader.
Yes, exactly. And of the Serengeti documentary on the wilderness.
Exactly.
So that concludes the very first piece on the Q Report. So we're going to go to a 30 seconds bit of music, and we'll come back with our next story.
A round of applause. Hey, we're back here at the Q Report. This is Mark Marbella. I'm with my gracious host, Patrick Martins. Wow. The cougar.
Feeling a little feisty. It's spring.
This is very exciting. This is our first Q Report, our first kickoff of the in this beautiful studio that has been handcrafted on the inside, which it's unbelievable. If you walking into it, it's this rusty green shipping container, as you described previously, with Alice Waters generously donated. But inside is this beautiful reclaimed wood. And it's just a gorgeous studio. I've been in studios, a lot of studios, and this one is particularly good. And it's good for the environment. So we're very happy. And thank you for this great effort that you've undertaken.
And thanks to everyone who's made a big part of making it possible. We want to also, including TechServe, the All Mac, All the Time store on 23rd Street. They're a really great company and very generous. And we want to thank them for their support of the Heritage Radio Network. So, Mark, tell us about this next story. I read this article, Daniel Langleben.
Mm-hmm.
And what does he tell
this
us?
This is a documentary series that I developed with the National Geographic Channel. With Dr. Langleben, who's from University of Pennsylvania, he does something very interesting. He is taking functional MRI, magnetic resolution imaging, and what that is they can see the brain actually operating. So they're studying the possibilities of what that means. So, you know, you can see what parts of the brain are lighting up when you're feeling or thinking about certain things. Of course, in his research, he's looking at it for security. So this is a scary aspect to it. The idea of looking into the brain and watching it light up and watching you lie or being able to, they can't do it yet, thankfully, but they're studying it.
They also studied something about the moral center of the brain in particular.
Yes, very interesting. There's always been a great argument over altruism and morality that it's particularly human. But as it turns out, the morality centers, the parts of the brain that light up when we're thinking about moral decisions, you know, if the way they do this, by the way, is if you've ever understand what an MRI is, you're sort of laying on your back and they're sort of taking a picture of your head. So they show you images or you read something as you're looking at it. So these moral decisions that people make. Example is the famous trolley car, the famous trolley car sort of experiment, which is that, you know, saving. Would you kill one person to save five? That's basically the premise.
And most people would kill one to save five, but only under certain circumstances.
Exactly. So the famous trolley car experiment, which is sort of an imaginary premise. Is that if you were in a switching tower and there was a runaway train and there was five workers on the track and you had the ability to switch the trolley car to a sidetrack to save those five people, but on that sidetrack there was one other man working, would you pull the switch to switch the car? Most people, the vast majority, three quarters, always say yes.
Switch, kill the guy, save the five.
Exactly. It's a pretty even moral, the math works. However, if with the same math, killing one man to save five, if people are asked to push a man in front of that trolley car to slow it down to stop it, killing that man, but of course you physically actually killing him, the majority, it reverses. 25% would still, but 75% say no.
That's very interesting. I mean, this is just an aside, but I've always asked people, if you go back in time and you saw little Hitler, baby Hitler, and you had a hammer, would you smash his brains in? And it's remarkable. Most of the people are like, no, that's not my job to do.
Yeah, and the answer, we can pretty much be sure that it would be the vast, maybe Hitler, maybe a little more, but still be vast minority who would do such a thing.
Well, what I found very interesting about the moral center of the brain is that it's actually hardwired into a very primitive part of the brain that actually exists in all animals, reptiles and everything. So we're not really unique in that we have a moral center.
Yes, they were very surprised, and it disturbs a lot of people to say that the moral center of the brain, again, we're talking about roots this hour here at Quotidian at the Q Report. The roots of morality is in the root of the brain, in the medulla oblongata, which sits on top of the spine, and that is the same part of the brain. It's often called the reptilian brain because all animals have that. It's just sort of higher forms have larger brains, like chimps or great apes. But the moral center, the things that fire off when we're thinking about this trolley car experiment, the very famous scenario, that's what fires off down there. So meaning it's embedded, it's genetic, and it's a very physical chemical process. It doesn't have anything to do with what your parents taught you right or wrong, or whether what religion you believe in it tells you in a moral sort of 10 moral laws to abide by. Now, of course, there's a socialization to those things, which is a separate thing. I wouldn't say we need to throw out laws, but mm-hmm. meaning the idea that people think often without religion or law, people would act chaotically. It may be for economic reasons more than moral reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. And, you know, I suppose what is that part of the primitive part of the brain in reptiles, for instance, is that why animals don't kill their offspring? Or?
Well, of course, even in the animal kingdom, they do kill if it's again, for economics, for scarcity. Chimps have been known to kill other chimps, and obviously, often males in the lion pack will eat or kill their young sometimes, but even others. For different reasons, but principally the higher forms of life and even the lower forms of life, there's a sociality. I mean, you can look at, you know, talk about lower forms of life, the bees and the ants. I mean, what are more social beasts than mm-hmm. that? They don't have brains like ours or even with lizards, but even iguanas on Galapagos, they live in a mm-hmm. very social environment.
So even Bill Clinton's book called Generosity, is that what it's called?
Yes, generosity.
It's maybe not so Clinton-esque as now, we think. It's actually very carnal, very
genetic. Well,
this
is very interesting when you're talking about generosity because, of course, people think morally on a local level. That is why it's difficult for people to... I mean, we understand when your neighbor is house burns down and everybody wants to donate because you can see the burned clothes and the mm-hmm. pictures and the kids standing on the street. But it's far more difficult for people to understand or emote or empathize with something that's very removed, like starvation in Africa, etc. Things that are, if we're talking about people in North America. Mm-hmm. So morality is very much of also a local... very much of a local communal thing. Staying local, as people understand, as they say, all politics is local. That actually, in fact, is scientifically true.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. Well, I mean, I was fascinated to read this. And where can people, is this a documentary you actually came out with? Where could people go and learn more information about this?
It's still in development. You can go to my website at marabellaproductions.com. We're still in development, and I'm talking to Dr. Lang LeBend all the time about it, so we're looking for an outlet. Actually, we had some interest from Discovery Canada, so we may be taking it international as well.
And I guess we'll be coming back more to the brain. I mean, we picked the brain for this. The article is called Mind Scan with Daniel Lang LeBend. And we brought it up because it talks about the root of probably the most core part of the world, which is the human brain.
Quite literally, the root of the brain.
And the fact that the moral center and generosity and being good to others, you know, even though it's complicated, you know, it's such a primitive part of the brain is pretty impressive.
Meaning altruism goes along in the same part of the brain that controls sex, urges for food, breathing, very basic functions of individual survival.
Very, very interesting. So we would like to thank, again, our sponsors for this hour of the Q Report, and they are called TechServe, and you can log on to their website via our website. And, you know, 1 hour after this show, or 2 hours after we complete our hour, people could go to the heritageradionetwork.com and search for any of the words that we had mentioned, any of the concepts, any of the themes, and it'll pull up right to the point in the audio stream where we brought up those issues. So the search engine is actually just as important as the live broadcast, especially if you miss the live broadcast or looking for information.
And also you can gather them all there and look at various days and segments and sort of gather, pick your favorite topics and listen to just those.
Fantastic. So we will fade to music. Although I do have a very cool one. I wanted to play this when the train was riding. Hold on.
That's right. So that would be the guy being thrown under. He's trying to get out.
Yeah, he's trying to get out. Doesn't sound like he did from the Flintstone sound effect. So here we are, Patrick Martins.
Mark Mirabella.
At the Q Report of the Heritage Radio Show on the Heritage Radio Network.
We are reporting on the Q.
On the Q. For those of you who just tuned in when we said Q, that stands for quotidien. Quotidien.
Look it up. It's really interesting. Look it up. Ironically, it means culture everywhere, everyday culture.
Everyday culture. Many people don't know that word, but they know le pain quotidien is the everyday bread, you know, the baguette in the back of the bicycle, basket.
Or how about pain?
Well,
the good pain.
In the last segment, you said all moral actions are local or something to that effect. And so this segment, which is going to last for about 8 more minutes, is a thing about a local Brooklyn monument.
Stay local, all about the roots, right? Today's about the roots.
Isn't this the first day of the cyclone?
Today is a very besides the auspicious launch of Heritage Radio here in Brooklyn, Bushwick, Brooklyn. Standing cue. There's also the opening, the first day of the cyclone, the Brooklyn Cyclone, which is actually a historic monument. Stands 85 feet tall against the sea, Atlantic coast. Despite what they're doing now, they're killing Astroland, as we all know. The New Yorkers are very sad about that. But I think the Mermaid Parade is still happening this year.
Is the cyclone, was it ever at risk?
It was at one point, but they saved it in 91. They made it a historic monument, a landmark, and so they can't destroy it. Part of the fun of that roller coaster, if you've been on it forward and backwards, is you're never sure if you're going to return to where you got on.
Right. I always think that there's no more metal on that roller coaster.
No.
Like even to keep you in, it's just tape.
It's gorgeous. It's very it's also very environmentally sound because it's mostly wood. So yes. You're just hoping that they've fixed all the beams that rotted over the winter, which is like it's a very severe environment that it sits in, salty next to the salty coast in freezing New York City. That's perfect, exactly. And you never know which way you're going. My wife refuses to ride on it, although I don't think she meets the height requirement either.
Would you like the front car or the back car?
I'm a back car man, yeah, personally. Yeah, because, you know, the front car is for sissies, I think, you know, because you can see it coming. But the back car, you have no idea what's going to happen next.
So that was just a fortunate time that the Cyclone was opening right when we're coming out with this story, which came out of the Daily Plant. Restoring grandeur to a Brooklyn landmark, the Prison Ship Martyrs Memorial.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know about this, and I didn't. I've lived in Brooklyn for, over 10, I guess it's 15 years now. It's my adopted home. I love Brooklyn. For the last week, I lived in Virginia for a bit, and we moved back to Fort Greene. And Fort Greene Park, they had a beautiful renovation of it. Fort Greene, the historic neighborhood, most famously, or many know it as Spike Lee's neighborhood, and among other artists and jazz musicians. But there's a park in the middle of it, highest point in Brooklyn. It was a fort during the Revolutionary War. And many people talk about Bunker Hill, the Revolutionary War, but really Brooklyn was the first battle. Mm-hmm. They always talk about the Revolution. It was the first battle after it was the Declaration of Independence that the Revolutionary War was written in ink in Philadelphia, but written in blood in Brooklyn.
Right. I mean, Brooklyn was the fort that tried to keep Manhattan and New York from the British, right?
That's right. And the British ultimately took it over. Mm-hmm. They lost it, which is why probably the Americans don't talk about it. And of course, as many people don't know, Brooklyn is part of Long Island, I mean, geographically speaking. So it's all a big island. So it was a very important thing to be able to militarily take it over, to be able to control Manhattan Island, Long Island, Brooklyn, basically all the ports. It was a huge strategy. Once they did that, the British set up these ships, these prison ships, in what is now the Navy Yard, which
makes sense, right? Because they didn't have any land here, or I mean, it would make sense that they would store people in their boats.
Yeah, kind of like we do now, which is Rikers Island. They have big barges, prison barges, except it's up further up the river in the East River.
Or in San Francisco, it's
what is that big island in the middle?
Somebody? Alcatraz.
Thank you very much. Alcatraz, a big rat. Actually, I don't think it's functioning as a prison anymore, but it still sits there.
And you can still pay like $25 and get a tour of where some guys escaped.
I know the sea lions like it.
And now this monument exists to honor. Now, many people don't know. I think I read that there was 11,000 prisoners.
11,500 more people died on those prison barges than all of the Revolutionary War combined.
I mean, that must have been the worst. Here are people that just arrived to America.
Right.
Could probably not get sick at the thought of looking at a boat and being kept in these very dark, dank, wet.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about the fact that they had also recently, you know, they were all immigrants, of course, and they were all political prisoners. They were put there if they had any sympathies to the revolution, which, of course, at the time in New York, a great many people sided with the British because, of course, that's
where the money was.
That's where the money was. So,
and also tradition and history, you know, not many colonies cut off from their mother country.
So it's pretty horrible. So this monument, you can see it. It's beautiful. It's lit up at night, and it's the tallest freestanding. I don't know anymore. At the time, it was the tallest freestanding Doric column, and it was the last thing that famous architect Stanford White, if you're unfamiliar, built the original Madison Square Garden, which is his version is now gone. But
Stanford White, huh? Was his last work.
It was his last work before he was famously shot to death on top of Madison Square Garden by a jealous lover.
Wow. So
it was a boyfriend. He was married, but he had a mistress, and this guy shot him over the mistress that he. He eventually made the other guy married. So a tragic tale of Stanford White, but he left this beautiful monument and the dead are still there. It's the largest burial of dead except for Arlington.
Really?
In America. Yeah.
And I know that this monument got a lot of attention. Borough President Marty
Moskowitz.
Markowitz, city council. He gave $3.7 million to refurbish this testament to all these soldiers that died. I guess in the Revolutionary War, people know it was tough, but you never really hear this side of history that so many, I guess, New Yorkers died, you know, in a really painful death.
Yeah, came into disrepair. We should say, though, just to be accurate, that there were other prisoners that they brought there. It was a sort of a, it was kind of like their Gitmo or their Abu Ghraib. I mean, ironically, at the time, it was the British doing it to the first Americans. And of course, they didn't conquer them, and they abandoned them when they had to leave very shortly thereafter when Washington crossed the Delaware back up into New York.
So now these 11,000 people died and are now all buried in Fort Greene Park?
Many of the remains are there. The monument was, it's amazing. I mean, talk about local. The monument was built because essentially when these people were dying, as they did every day, the British soldiers would come around and say, you know, bring out your dead. They had no place to bury them, so they buried them on the shore. And what happened after the revolution is that these remains kept washing up. These bones kept literally washing up on shore, and they said, we have to do something. And they created this. It was Walt Whitman, a famous Brooklynite, who created... It was Walt Whitman, this famous Brooklynite, who created the monument. He was the one who said, we have to do something for these fallen men. And that's what happened.
Very, very interesting. I mean, the Revolutionary War is just a, you know, fascinating time. I mean, it was such a long time ago. I mean, people really don't think about it, but... These were known as the prison ship martyrs, correct?
That's correct.
Well, hey, Heather, how many minutes to 10 minutes? We're done. All right. Well, I did want to talk about one last thing about the food back then and the fact that...
It's fantastic. Talking about Food Inc.?
Well, yeah, Food Inc. I mean... The reason I bring this up with this whole Brooklyn Monument thing is that people basically didn't eat much better then than they do now. I mean, people talk about the muckrakers and, you know, Eric Schlosser kind of revealed in Fast Food Nation that people back in 1900 didn't really eat much better than they do today. I mean, things haven't really improved.
Except the new documentary, Food Inc., in which he appears along with Michael Pollan, famous food writer as well. He makes the point that the documentarian Robert Kenner makes the point to say that up until 40 years ago, the food has changed radically, more than it had in the previous 10,000 years. I mean, it's I think we're all experiencing the health effects and the obesity and the diabetes that are happening to our children, of all people, not just to adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, very interesting. Well, we are going to get to. I mean, one of the things I was going to say is. You know, this Brownfield news thing says, no sooner is HBO's Death on a Factory Farm released, than there comes another, what they call the cinematic jab at agriculture. You know, I mean, the jab is what's happening to every single animal, you know, in industrial confinement. I don't know why all of a sudden this is so dramatic. One documentary out of 50 trillion.
A big threat to Arm & Hammer and everybody else in Monsanto. All these gigantic corporations. I mean, we all have to eat. You know, it's the largest industry and it's all controlled. What Kenner, the filmmaker, talks about. By the way, we should say that Participant Films and Magnolia have picked up Participant. If you're unfamiliar, everybody should check out the website participantfilms.com. They do films like Inconvenient Truth, with a social cause, Jimmy Carter, Man from Plains, that you can get involved with. You should check out the trailer. It's really amazing. But His biggest surprise about the story was that it was also a First Amendment issue, meaning the corporations are not only doing these things, they don't want anybody to know, of course. Uh-huh. And so, and part of how he got access, which was really interesting to me as a documentarian, he went through the FDA and the USDA, which is pretty rare. So he followed with the inspectors of what was going on. Just a natural thing. It's not an expose. This is just how it works.
Right. And anyway, I can't wait to see this film. Brownfield Ag News for America says that it's billed as a documentary, and they put documentary in quotes. I'm just like, and they look at this. They gave it the three sentences. You know, I mean, not really.
What is Brownfield? It's ag news. Is this news that?
I guess it's commodity ag. Yeah. Because for them to say that Eric Schlosser is, you know, BSingly calling something a documentary when it's not, and to define what his role is in America as jabbing agriculture. Is really sad, because that footage didn't lie in the HBO series either.
No, it's simply saying the truth. I wouldn't say it's going too far overboard. I mean, if you've seen the trailer, it has beautiful imagery of things we're all very familiar with. He makes the point that there's 47,000 products in an average supermarket. I mean, just insane amount. As we're traveling, the film opens with him traveling through a supermarket, and mm-hmm. he's looking at these products, and you know. There's a reason why obesity and diabetes are happening when a Big Mac costs more than a head of broccoli.
100%
costs less than a head of broccoli. So there's a choice. There's an economic choice there, of course.
Well, our next segment is going to be about roots. This segment was about Brooklyn roots and a little bit the root of our food. And next, we're going to talk about the difference between heritage and a commodity. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Mark Mirabella.
We are being produced by Nat Wiener is our engineer, and Heather Hyman is our producer.
Heather Nat.
And we are at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
On a gorgeous, beautiful spring day.
And it's really a lovely restaurant. You can see the studio from the outside, from the garden area. There's a roof garden. And it actually brings us to the second to last segment of our first Q report on roots as the theme. And that's something we came up with on the phone last night, Mark. What is the difference between heritage and a commodity?
That was my question to you, Patrick. What is the difference? I mean, a lot of people, I'm very interested in the subject in the documentaries that I do, although it's interesting, you know, for the documentaries that I sell to television, they never want to do anything on heritage foods. And I'm guessing it's probably because it's against most of their sponsors. But tell us the difference. First of all, how is... We just came off of Food Inc., Robert Kenner's new film with
Eric Schlosser
and Pollen. Tell us.
Pollen. Yeah. You just threw Pollen in there.
I like him.
Yeah.
The Botany of Desire.
He's also a founder of the network. Why not?
Tell us about how the food works. How does Food Inc. work? The commodity.
Well, the commodity to me seems, you know, if I were to be asked what is a commodity, I would define it as the lowest common denominator, like the pure lowest of the low, you know, while still vaguely being able to be called the same thing. Like you can still put it in a supermarket, but everything about it is kind of trashy. We're coming out with a book actually called Slow Business, which is being published out of England. And we are very, very critical of food, especially where greed overwhelms the thing it's supposed to be. And with commodities, you have, you know, just how can we squeak out even a hundredth of a cent out of, you know, a cow or a pig? How can we make it grow faster? How can we make it eat less or more? You know, whatever you're trying to do.
How can you make it? How can you make it specific to knowing what your costs are? 1 pound equals 2 pound. 1 pound of feed equals 2 pounds of meat.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird and gross. But you know, I was thinking about this actually after our conversation. People don't start out wanting to, you know, create poisonous, terrible tasting food. It sort of turns into that because they're protecting this fantastic market, this market that's growing, and et cetera. How does it get to be to that extent where the biodiversity they're to the extent we're talking about 1 pound of feed to 2 pounds of meat?
Well, I guess, you know, one question is Marion Nestle brings up a good point. That people can only eat so much, you know, mankind will only eat so much. And so food companies have the challenge, how can we sell more? How can we make more money? And the way to do that is to, you know, either get people to eat more, you know, find new foods that people don't really need, or save money on the food that is being grown. You know, that's a way to make more money, is to save money. So it's basically, you know, something, a phenomenon that started about 60 years ago, you know, after World War II, but, you know, has also... The other side has never died, and that's the heritage side. And when we were putting down some key words, you know, photosynthesis was one of them. And Michael Pollan actually said that that is the most important agricultural act that there is.
Very interesting. And our guest coming up talks about grass management, and really is really what they're doing.
Do you think grass-fed beef tastes as good as corn-fed?
Yeah, absolutely.
It does. I mean, it's a little leaner, you know, corn does add a certain something, but like Will Harris has done, you know, a good job raising, you know, fattier versions of grass fed.
But how are, you know, not to muddy the subject, but, you know, the idea of mad cow, of feeding a ruminant, an animal that only is supposed to eat grass, meat products, is just disgusting to begin with. I mean, and then what a big surprise that they're getting sick from it. I mean, it's just, you know.
They're eating themselves. It's down cow, chop it up, feed it back to the cows. I mean, those guys need to be put in jail for that. You know, I mean, literally in jail for doing that, because, you know, I hear that there could be mad pig disease out there, just that they kill the pigs before that virus has a chance to manifest itself.
Right, and of course, my great interest, we'll come back to photosynthesis. My great interest in this is biodiversity, meaning if there's only certain breeds of pigs and turkeys and chickens and cows that can put on the meat in a certain amount of time with a certain amount of type of feed, mm-hmm. then there's only very few breeds that can and diseases is susceptible to, and so are we. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to segue now into and talk about heritage, and that's a good reason too. It's like something's going to kill us no matter what it is. It's just the greatest protection is diversity in your food supply.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're one novel pathogen away from seeing the entire turkey industry or chicken industry wiped off of the American landscape. Just like potatoes, and the only food supply was, you know, wiped off the Irish landscape a century ago. People starved to death, you know, taking so for granted that we were in good hands. And right. really, what we realized is that even the people who run the food businesses were so far removed from the source that really our food destinies are in the hands of, you know, 60-year-old, probably minimally overweight, white men, you know, in Texas boardrooms.
Yes, that's true. So tell us, define here. And there are some of those ilk who are in Texas who are heritage farmers as well. But tell us, define heritage. What does heritage mean for people who don't know?
I think heritage means basically, you know, something that you inherit. And I don't think one generation of fast food is enough to consider that we inherited that. I think more importantly, we inherited, you know, the proper way to raise livestock outdoors, you know, where really the animal was almost an extended part of the family. And
it's interesting you bring that point. We brought that point up last segment with Food Inc. that it's a very recent phenomenon, fast food. It's very recent, and we can come back to, again, photosynthesis, that a lot of this stuff is raised on the inside. I mean, there's mm-hmm. They're deprived of light and soil. I mean, imagine yourself being raised in this container.
Well, that's why you need, actually, that wouldn't be so bad. But the feasibility, let me just ask you, we have about 30 seconds left.
Sure.
Do you think it is feasible to feed the world on heritage or slow or grass-fed or organic? You know, do you think you can feed the world using those kind of hippie concepts?
I don't see why not. I mean, what's wrong with getting our food from farmers? There's farms everywhere. They don't need to be grown in such horrible ways.
Well, I think urban farming is a big answer to that. We can talk about that later. In fact, we have a garden growing on our roof. So we're going to cut away for about 30 seconds, and then we're going to come back with one of our favorite guests, Brian Kenny, Hearst Ranch. And here we are for the final segment of
Tom Waits bringing us in. Tom
Curry. Of the Q report. I mean, I think it has been nothing but fierce, this first Q report. So I would like to welcome Brian Kenny, who's a beef farmer, which is why I nickname him Chateaubriand. And welcome, Brian.
Thanks, guys. Can you turn my signal up to my phone up a little bit? I can barely hear you.
We'll talk closer to the mic.
Is that better?
Okay. I'll do my best then.
How's the weather over there, Brian?
You know, it's sunny. I'm in Alameda, California, where I dwell. I was hoping for rain at the Jack Ranch, which is our valley ranch down in Chelan, which is where James Dean passed away.
Hmm.
And also at the San Simeon Ranch, which is our coast ranch where the Hearst Castle is. But we didn't get it yet.
And there's no... explain a little bit about the farm that you don't have water supply in the sense you have to wait for rain.
Well, we have water, but we also have a bunch of ground that we dry farmed. And what that means is that, you know, we cultivate the soil, put seed in, and then nature's our irrigation. And so it's the equivalent of... This is how agriculture's practiced in large parts of the country, specifically in the breadbasket of the Midwest. But in California, we are in the third year of a drought, and this is essentially a gamble, I guess.
What do you have planted there? Are they starting to die, or 3 years without rain, is that feasible for a farm?
Does the diet of the cows change because of that?
No, not really. We do the dry farm stuff that we're doing are baleable forage crops, and we use it as part of our drought protection program, and which we really got very serious about last year and even more serious this year. So basically, the grass cycle in California at our ranches starts in about March. The Jack Ranch, which is our valley ranch, we can maybe get till May. If we get the right amount of rain. And what happens with the grasses, including the baleable forage crops that aren't irrigated, is that they'll grow, they'll reach a point of stress when they need water, and they'll stop growing at that point. And then it's basically, there's this fine line between when they're still potentially salvageable with some rain and when they're done, and they're basically going to end up turning brown or turning yellow, rather.
Brian, can
and
you...
then we'll cut them or we'll graze them at that point. But
can you give
them for weaning cattle and also baling for drought protection? Because in the winter, you know, once you get to the end of the summer till, you know, about September, you're left with residual dry matter. And even on that ranch is 75,000 acres. But it's hard to get to a lot of that ground. And so with your cow herd... you'll need to feed them.
Brian, can you give us a little bit of a geography? Because California is so large, there's so many microclimates. Just tell us specifically. It's really important to understand specifically where that is. Because, you know, just by geography doesn't really do it for California, because it depends on how the winds are, etc.
Okay, well, we are halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And the San Simeon Ranch is on the coast. It's about 40 miles north of San Luis Obispo. And it's pretty much directly halfway between San Francisco and L.A.
And tell us how that climate varies compared to the valley.
Well, the valley, the Jack Ranch is 60 miles away east, kind of northeast, barely north, but east. And the climate is such that the coastal influence, the San Simeon Ranch has a coastal terrace on the front side, and it's kind of in a, it's almost like a V, a very strange calligraphy V, but anyway, it's... The San Simeon Ranch is five times the size of Manhattan.
Wow.
It'll basically, the front third of it is coastal terrace. And so there's a coastal influence there. And so, you know, last year, for instance, we got by on the front end of the ranch we kept the grasses, or nature kept the grasses alive with the coastal influence and morning fog. The morning, a serious fog is like a light rain. So that's a big deal.
It looks like San Francisco
at the Jack
in that
Ranch,
way.
We didn't get that. We had, I think, 4.5 inches of rain at the Jack Ranch last year.
Now, let me ask you, Brian, just to tie it in, because we have three more minutes before you become the first farmer of the Farm Hour, hosted by producer Heather Hyman and mail order guru for Heritage Foods. What is the difference between commodity beef production and what you do at Hearst Ranch? That was the theme we were before.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, the difference is, to a certain extent, in our cow-calf program, we have a base herd of cattle, about 3,000 cattle between the two ranches. Maybe it's 3,100. Probably 300 bulls, I think, the last I looked. And so we produce calves, either steer calves or heifer calves. And that's what we've been doing operationally for over 140 years. And we do it with a Angus Hereford cross. And the Angus Hereford cross is actually one that is used in the feedlots. And we still sell calves into that channel. Just because of the size and scope of our ranches, we could raise a lot more calves than we could feed into finished grass-fed cattle. Mm. So, but you know, we do that. So basically, the difference is not in the way that the calves are raised; it's in the way that the calves go to yearlings and go to being a finished weight animal. And so, on the commodity side, you have feedlots, which are really the only efficient way. From a business perspective, it's really the only efficient, controlled way to turn a feed product into animal protein. And so the difference between the commodity side and our side is that on our side, we take solar energy, which turns into grass, and we turn it into animal protein. And on the commodity side, it's really more petroleum dependent than that. So you're using grain crops for a variety of reasons, but primarily, I mean, it's efficient because it adds intermuscular fat, and cattle can't really metabolize it like they can grass. They've evolved for millions of years to turn cellulose into energy and protein. So that's our system's dependent on solar energy, really, and it goes all the way through the process. I mean, we still use cattle dogs and horses and cowboys. Hmm.
Yeah, there's
cowboys,
a lot of
you're a cowboy.
There's a lot of trucking involved. There's a lot of trucking involved in the commodity.
You wear cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. That's how I can always see Brian from a crowded room at the Hearst Center. Well, Brian, I know you're going to be a guest on 100 more times, if not more, especially on the Q Report, maybe even as soon as next week. So, this basically concludes, you are like a bridge from the quotidian report to the farm report.
Oh, wow.
Which is going to be, you know, 20 questions to small farmers. So, I mean, small farmers, good farmers. So thank you for being on, and after this 3-minute song, we will come on and learn about your farm.
Okay, super. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
I came into town on a beautiful day, saw a pretty girl was looking my way. All those around me said, son, beware of the little girl with the golden hair. Don't give your heart to a Knoxville girl, she'll only play you for a fool. She'll pick you up and let you down fast, her kind of
My name is Heather, and I am...